Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 321, Thursday, December 20th, 2018.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, Sea Realm Vault subscribers, KMO here. It is 5:30 a.m. for me. I've taken to waking up in the middle of the night, and this last night I woke up at a little after 3, lay in bed till about 4:10, and then I decided, you know what, I'm just going to have to start the day because I'm probably not going back to sleep. This past year, as I've mentioned on numerous occasions, my New Year's resolutions were to abstain from both alcohol and marijuana, but I was rather reliant on marijuana as a sleep aid. And in its absence, I've become reliant on melatonin. But melatonin helps me get to sleep, but it doesn't keep me asleep, whereas marijuana before bed will pretty much guarantee that I sleep until, you know, the sun comes up the next day. Anyway, today I decided not to... There's few things more frustrating. Well, there's a lot that's frustrating in the world, but one of them is lying in bed, knowing you should be asleep, and not feeling the least bit sleepy. So I got up, played some Plants vs. Zombies, fed the cat, and now I think I'm going to read to you an article, an entire article from Harper's Magazine from back in 2012. This came from a Sea Realm Vault subscriber whose name I will not mention, because he admitted to wrongdoing, not wrongdoing, but to illegal activity, basically, in finding something behind a paywall, converting it into a PDF, and sending it to me as an email attachment. But he says this is his favorite article on fasting. And as I say, it's from Harper's Magazine back in 2012. The article is called Starving Your Way to Vigor, The Benefits of an Empty Stomach by Steve Hendricks. And as I read it, I am going to break in with commentary of my own and observations. I suppose I should mention that I am on day 6 of what I've decided will be a 7-day fast. So it is Thursday morning, early Thursday morning. It is dark outside. And I last ate on Friday afternoon of last week. So I'm going to break my fast on Saturday morning with some bone broth. Also, on Monday of this week, I was thinking about food, and I ordered on Amazon 2 boxes of 2 different varieties of my favorite protein bars. One is from Pure Protein. I got the caramel and sea salt version, and the other is a Quest bar, and it's the chocolate chip cookie dough. So I have these sitting on the shelf. A few of you know, I can tell from the download numbers and the viewership numbers, that most of you listening to this podcast have not seen any of my recent YouTube videos. I've taken to doing one a day. I'll say more about that later. But most of the videos are shot here in the apartment, and I've got a particular backdrop, which is just some shelves with some plants on them. And sitting on those shelves are these boxes of protein bars that I've ordered. And while I look at them fondly and anticipate eating them in the future, I know I couldn't just bust open one now and eat one because I would suffer for it. Those are not the things on which to break a long fast. Anyway, this article, again, it is called Starving Your Way to Vigor. It's by Stephen Hendricks, and it begins with a bit of history. Stephen Hendricks writes, 2 weeks after a 4th of July, at the end of Reconstruction, a doctor in Minneapolis named Henry S. Tanner resolved to end his life. His wife had left him some years earlier in favor of Duluth, which may have spoken to the quality of his husbandship, and his efforts to reacquire her had failed. He had been a lecturer on temperance, which is to say not drinking, but not a rousing one. He had owned a Turkish bathhouse, but not a successful one, and his health was poor in a manner not specified. The usual methods of self-destruction being too painful or too messy or too likely to succeed, Tanner decided to starve himself. At the time, the consensus among men of science was that a human could not survive more than 10 days without food. Christ may have fasted 40, but this was thought to be a special case. On July 17, 1877, Tanner drank a pint of milk and repaired to bed. He passed some days hungrily. His physician, one Dr. Moyer, urged him to eat, but Tanner was firm. Only water crossed his lips. Presently, odd things happened. His hunger vanished, and he ceased to think of food. With each new day, his ailments, whatever their origin, diminished. And by the 10th day, which should, by the wisdom of the moment, have been his last, the ills that had plagued him were completely gone. Far from nearing death, he was possessed of a renewed strength. It had been his custom to walk 1 to 3 miles twice daily, and after the 10th day he resumed these constitutionals. If his step was shaky at first, it quickly grew steady. He judged his recovery complete and bade Dr. Moyer, who had kept a nervous vigil, bring him food. But while the food was being prepared, Tanner turned to a thought that had lately come to him. If a man might not only survive, but indeed thrive after 10 foodless days, what would be the limit of his unfed endurance? 20 days? 30? More? And what would the answer say about us? Did it imply, for example, that we were meant to go without food for long periods? If so, why? Was fasting perhaps a healing mechanism, like sleep? It was the sort of pons asinorum that will gnaw at a person of a certain turn of mind until he must have an answer. By the time Moyer brought his meal, Tanner had come to a resolution. He would forego gratification of the stomach for gratification of the mind. By the way, pons asinorum is the point at which many learners fail, especially a theory or formula that is difficult to grasp. And according to Wikipedia, in geometry, the statement that the angles opposite the equal sides of an isosceles triangle are themselves equal is known as the pons asinorum, typically translated as bridge of asses. The statement is proposition 5 in book 1 of Euclid's Elements and is known as the isosceles triangle theorem. Its converse is also true. If two angles of a triangle are equal, then the sides opposite them are also equal. The name of this statement is also used metaphorically for a problem or challenge which will separate the sure of mind from the simple, the fleet thinker from the slow, the determined from the dallier, to represent a critical test of ability or understanding. Very good. Back to the article. Although I'll back up. It was the sort of pons asinorum that will gnaw at a person of a certain turn of mind until he must have an answer. By the time Moyer brought his meal, Tanner had come to a resolution. He would forego gratification of the stomach for gratification of the mind. 10 fasted days became 15, then 20, then 25. He noted no great changes in his person save loss of weight. Reconstruction was an era of proud midriffs, and doctors did not regard slimming as a benefit, per se. Tanner did acknowledge a slight slowness in cogitation, chiefly on complicated subjects, but otherwise his mental powers were undiminished. On reaching 4 foodless weeks, he celebrated by walking 10 miles of riverbank to Minnehaha Falls and back. He later walked Lakes Calhoun and Cedar, but after drinking from those bodies, he contracted gastritis, and Moyer again urged him to end his fast. On the 40th day, Tanner relented, taking a small glass of milk. He had bested Christ. Tanner's fast might have been lost to history, but for a challenge issued 1 year later by a Manhattan doctor named Hammond. Dr. Hammond had reservations about the well-publicized claims of one Molly Fancher, a Brooklynite, who lived for years without food and achieved powers of clairvoyance. He wrote Miss Fancher a $1,000 check, sealed it in an envelope, and announced that the draft was hers if she could divine the number of the check and the name of the issuing bank. Furthermore, if she would fast for a month under the observation of doctors, he would add an equal sum to her fortune. Now, this is the 19th century, so $1,000 was nothing trivial. Miss Fancher spurned the check-reading challenge on the grounds that her divinatorial powers could not be rented, and she declined the fasting challenge on grounds that decency did not allow her to be examined by male physicians. Learning of Miss Fancher's demurral, Tanner traveled to New York to take up the fasting half of the challenge. When he and Hammond failed to come to terms, Tanner proceeded without the incentive, raising the dare from a month to 40 days. He arranged for the use of a public hall in which to fast and for lecturers and students of the United States Medical College to monitor him. Because the college was what would be described today as naturopathic, the term then was eclectic, and because Tanner was himself a naturopathic doctor, establishmentarian doctors eschewed the affair. Establishments like nothing so little as progress not established by themselves. Thus, it was that on a summer's morning in 1880, the unlikely Tanner, his person having been examined for hidden food and his vitals recorded for statistical baselines, took the stage at Clarendon Hall on East 13th Street. His furnishings consisted of a cot, a cane-backed rocker, and a gas-fired chandelier. The spareness of the set and the light of the chandelier were meant to dispel suspicions that he had secreted food about him. At the stroke of noon, he took a seat in the rocker and proceeded to do nothing. This he supplemented as the hours passed with a little reading, a little drinking of water, and a little chatting with his public, the size of which would be familiar to a short story writer on book tour today. A week into this regimen, he had lost more than a dozen of his 157.5 pounds. His audience grew with the approach of the lethal 10th day. At the dawn of the 11th, with Tanner still extant, the public's curiosity became wonder, and more spectators appeared, at 2 bits a head, which is to say 25 cents a head for admission. News of Tanner's survival traveled the continent by telegraph and newspaper. Well-wishers near and far sent him gifts of flowers, slippers, mattresses, exercise gear, roast beef, canned milk, gin, and claret. As many as 400 letters arrived daily, each scanned by the collegians for contraband comestibles. Among the corresponders were a gentlewoman in Philadelphia who proposed marriage, should he live, and the director of a museum in Maine who proposed to stuff and display him, should he not. The ladies of New York arrived to serenade him at piano, and learned gentlemen sounded him on matters of health. Soon, telegraphs from Europe were congratulating him on his feat. Toward the end of his allotted time, Tanner was drawing roughly 1,000 spectators a day. His share of the gate would come to $137.64. On the 40th morning, the collegians weighed him at 121.5 pounds, 36 fewer than when he had begun. His other vitals were interesting only for being uninteresting. Normal pulse, normal respiration. At noon, he ate a peach, which went down without trauma. He followed with 2 goblets of milk, which the collegians thought him prudent, on a stomach so long inactive. But the milk, not troubling him either, he ate most of a Georgia watermelon, to his colleagues' horror. In succeeding hours, he added a modest 1/2 pound of broiled beefsteak, a like amount of sirloin, and 4 apples. His lubrication was wine and ale. By the following evening, he had reclaimed 8.5 pounds. Okay, I'm going to stop here and say that there is no way in hell I would eat 1/2 pound of boiled beefsteak and a similar amount of sirloin on the first day after a long fast. That seems crazy to me. Continuing. By the following evening, he had reclaimed 8.5 pounds. After 3 days, he had regained 19.5, and after five more, had recouped all of his lost 36 pounds. The question of which was the greater marvel, surviving his starvation or surviving his wanton refeeding, remains, in light of later learning about fasting, open to debate. In the age of Victoria, however, his ability to recover bulk was a credit in fasting's ledger, proof his famine had not sapped him. Tanner had hoped to persuade skeptics that fasting was curative, but in New York he had no disease to heal. He was a pitchman without a product. Scientists ignored him, the laity did not experiment at home, and the Times synopsized his feat as Tanner's folly, echoing Seward's of a decade earlier. But Tanner knew that such benightedness had long greeted men of genius, from Socrates to Galileo. Time, he doubted not, would vindicate him. It is a thin imagination that would not be titillated by Tanner's tale, and at the time I became acquainted with it, I was thin of neither body nor mind. Several years earlier, for reasons now puzzling, I had been a distance runner, but a pitiable knee injury ended all of that, after which lard came upon me. Its accumulation was so gradual that I didn't perceive it until I saw a couple of family photographs. Who was that shapeless man holding hands with my wife? That doughy guy with his arm around my brother? Vanity was not my only concern. Fat, in our era, is disease, decrepitude, and death. The odds of incurring diabetes or high blood pressure, respiratory or kidney failure, thrombosis or embolism, gout or arthritis, migraine or dementia, cardiac arrest or stroke, gallstones or cancer all increase with one's ballast. Although by American standards I could not properly be called fat, my weight being somewhere in the loftier 160s, even this mass, the World Health Organization deemed unhealthy for a man 5'9", and some distant athletic part of me was compelled to agree. Had my weight seemed likely to settle there, my concern might not have been great, but my gains gave no sign of slowing. As in a bad novel, I could see where the plot was headed. I resolved to fast. Okay, so this guy's 5'9", and he thought he was fat and weighing 160-something. I'm 6'1", and at the start of my fast, I weighed 216, or maybe 214. Oddly, I had lost a couple of pounds after I resolved to start my fast, but before I actually started it. But I weighed myself this morning, and I was 203 point something. I forget the point something. So I've lost roughly 10 pounds in 6 days of fasting. But when I first read this article, and the author said that, you know, he was disgusted with himself weighing 160-something, I just rolled my eyes. It's like he wants to be a human skeleton. If I weighed 160, I would be looking to gain weight for sure. Anyway, continuing. My ambitions were at first untannerly. I fasted a day, and all went well. 2 weeks later, I repeated the performance with a similar result. A few weeks after that, I fasted again, then again. Soon I felt myself master of the one-day fast. I upped the stakes to 2 days, then three, and eventually, in what was a marvel to me, a week. I lost a few pounds, and my ambition crept up on me. I thought of a fast for weeks. The plural excited me. I would aim for 140 pounds, my collegiate weight, although to reach it, I would have to fast to 135. Fasting is mildly dehydrating, and the faster, on returning to food, rapidly re-accrues a few liquid pounds. He also, again, carries a semi-constant pound or two of solids in his gut. The typical long-haul faster, so I had read, loses about a pound a day, so I figured I could reach 135 in a bit over 3 weeks. I made my preparations. The short fast requires little or no groundwork, but longer deprivations, I had also read, are best undertaken after a week or so on a fibrous, low-fat diet. Vegetables, fruits, and whole grains are counseled, meat and dairy discouraged, the idea being to smooth out what was in one's interior. To do otherwise is to invite meals to linger in the bowels long after the fast starts, which could be painful at best, damaging at worst. I ate according to plan, and on a Sunday night had a last supper of whole wheat rigatoni and marinara, bland but purgative. I weighed myself. The scale read 160 pounds, a round 160, you might say. I went to bed with visions of a lesser me dancing in my head. In the early 1900s, after a couple of fallow decades, fasting enjoyed a brief revival, chiefly by way of Bernard McFadden. In books and in magazines of his founding, Physical Culture, The Miracle of Milk, Superb Virility of Manhood, McFadden propounded the then radical ideas about health, from the salutary effects of salad and vigorous sex to the evils of processed food and pill pushers. He recommended fasts of a week, and to show that they invigorated rather than enervated, he published photographs of his finely carved self at the end of his fasts, lifting one-armed 100-pound weights above his head. Thousands of disciples followed his advice, fasting either at home or in his healthatorium, and for a while, it seemed fasting might spread into the broader national consciousness. But in time, McFadden faded from public attention, and fasting with it. Out of the public eye, however, a few scientists, less known than McFadden, but more methodical, had become intrigued by the art. It was Frederick Madison Allen, a physician at New York's Rockefeller Institute, who was renowned for his work on childhood diabetes. Allen theorized that since diabetes was a disease of excess glucose, taking glucose away by, say, fasting, might ease a diabetic's symptoms. He further theorized that any improvements achieved by fasting might be maintained afterward by a diet very low in carbohydrates, the raw material of glucose. Alan fasted dozens of children for 1 week or more, and it seemed to him that they did not fall into diabetic comas as readily as patients treated with the standard palliatives. Alan, however, had no control group, and his conclusions were more impressionistic than scientific. The chief deficiency of the Alan plan, as his therapy became known, was that a large portion of his patients died. With the discovery of insulin a few years later, the Alan plan fell into disuse. Contemporaneously, one H. Raul Jayelan, a professor of medicine at Columbia, was puzzling over the severe seizures of a boy who had not responded to bromide and phenobarbital, the leading epileptic treatments of the day. His parents decided to fast him, and on the second day, without food, his seizures ceased. Three more times over as many months, the child was fasted, and he remained seizure-free for 2 years, at which point his case record ends. Impressed, Jayelan proceeded to fast 26 epileptic subjects for lengths of 5 to 26 days, then fasted some a second and a third time. The great majority of them stopped seizing during their fasts, and the seizures of the rest diminished to one degree or another. Alas, seizures returned in full to 6 patients on breaking their fasts, but the other 20 had few or no seizures for weeks or months, and 2 remained seizure-free for at least a year. A handful of researchers, expanding on Jayelan's work, hypothesized that since fasters survived by eating their own fat, perhaps putting epileptics on a fatty diet would also help them. The researchers fasted patients, then fed them on high-fat foods, and over the long term, the majority of patients had improved dramatically. Many hospitals adopted the treatment, but after a new generation of anticonvulsants was developed in the 1930s, it fell, like the Alan plan, into disuse. A consumerist pattern was emerging. Starvation, a remedy that cost nothing, indeed cost less than nothing since the starver stopped purchasing food, was abandoned whenever a costly cure was developed. Decades later, studies would show that fasting followed by a high-fat diet was as effective against seizures as many modern anticonvulsants, and that variants of the Alan diet were effective against diabetes. But America, then as now, preferred the promise of the pill over the modification of menu. I passed Monday morning, the first of my fast, with no evidence of appetite. By afternoon, however, my stomach, I use the term in its general, non-clinical sense, was encircled by emptiness. Soon I felt it contracting, and now and then it murmured aggrievedly. For recompense, I felt none of the sleepiness I usually feel after lunch. Indeed, I was sharply alert, presumably because my body, not needing energy to digest food, was sending the surplus to my brain. My stomach grew increasingly resentful as the afternoon progressed, but I felt no hunger. This must sound odd to anyone who has skipped a meal or two, but I had learned a few tricks of the anti-hunger trade. One of my earliest teachers was Gandhi, veteran of 17 hunger strikes, and deviser of a set of precepts about fasting. The majority of the precepts, take regular enemas, sleep out of doors, I honored in the breach. 2, however, I held close. 1 was to drink as much cool water as possible, a rule that later fasters improved on by recommending that the faster drink whenever a thought of food arises. Gandhi's other worthy precept was simply to banish thoughts of food the instant they spring up. At first, I had thought this advice insipid. It seemed to me that a faster, at least a non-Mahatma faster, could no more will away a mental masala than an alcoholic could a mental whiskey sour. But later-day fasters had again helpfully elaborated. In this case, by likening thoughts of food to internet pop-up ads, which disappear with a simple click of a red X. A faster, my teacher said, had only to click the X, and they would go away. It worked just so for me, to my appreciative surprise. For nearly half a century after the 1930s, only the odd doctor, often in both senses of the adjective, prescribed the hunger cure for illness. What few fasting healthatoriums and clinics remained were chiefly in Europe, particularly Germany. An American exception was Herbert McGolphin Shelton, a McFaddenite, who set up a fasting clinic in San Antonio. The location, deep in Longhorn steer country, testified to Shelton's attitude toward convention. From the 1930s through the 1970s, Shelton fasted perhaps 30,000 patients. Along the way, he preached raw foodism, accepted the presidential nomination of the American Vegetarian Party, received an invitation from Gandhi, not consummated, to explore fasting together. and collected a grant of $50,000 from the creator of the Fritos corn chip, who possibly hoped to make amends. In his copious writings, Shelton claimed to have fasted away the ailments of dyspeptics and depressives, rheumatics and cardiacs, epileptics and diabetics, the cancerous and the gouty. He had even, he wrote, made one or two of the lame rise and walk again. A historian of fasting, had one existed, might have looked askance at Shelton's claims. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Hippocrates, and Galen all advised short fasts to rid the mind of clutter and the body of malady. Instead of employing medicines, Plutarch counseled, fast a day. It is said that Pythagoras, on applying to study in Egypt, was required to fast for 40 days. He grumpily complied, but afterward declared himself a man reborn, and later made his matriculating pupils fast. The ancient belief in curative fasting dribbled down to a few of Tanner's contemporaries, among them Shaw and Twain, the latter of whom wrote, quote, "A little starvation can really do more for the average sick man than can the best medicines and the best doctors. I speak from experience. Starvation has been my cold and fever doctor for 15 years and has accomplished a cure in all instances." Close quote. To a perceptive 20th century researcher, the line of sages who claimed vigor through fasting might have suggested a topic worthy of study, but perception was rare, and science largely dismissed curative fasting. Shelton, in turn, dismissed science, or, as he styled it, science as unscientific. He opined, quote, "Science stubbornly clings to its errors and resists all efforts to correct these. Once an alleged fact has been well established, no matter how erroneous it is, all the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Close quote. On Tuesday morning, 36 hours into my fast, I felt not quite right, but in a way that is difficult to capture in words. I felt a little weak, or maybe it was a little light, and I had the sensation that my being was centered in my head, or was trying to be, but that my head was too full of other things to hold all of me. I did not, however, have a headache. My discomfiture was remote, although the alertness I had enjoyed the day before had abandoned me utterly. In its place was a heavy, insistent somnolence. I napped in the morning and again at tea time, but did not awake from either respite refreshed. I stumbled through the day, lethargic. So, for me, this period of the fast was on Sunday. That's the day that I had the conversation with Dermot O'Connor, which was the last episode of this podcast. And I felt odd and restless and unsatisfiable in a way that was difficult to describe. I didn't take long naps, though, and I'm a fairly regular afternoon napper. In fact, I've slept less, I would say, since I've been fasting, and I've had trouble sleeping. Returning to the article, endurance fasters say the hardest part of their labor is from roughly the second through fourth days. During this time, the body is exhausting its store of glycogen, the compound that is broken into glucose in order to fuel, among other things, the brain. The brain is ravenous. Though just 2% of the body's mass, it uses 20% of its resting energy, and the body's other main source of energy, amino acids, which are broken down from proteins, and fatty acids and glycerol, which are broken down from fats, cannot power the brain. This is a bother, because we store pound on pound of fat, which most of us would just as soon burn for fuel, whereas we store only a few ounces of glycogen. Our brains are thus on a nearly constant prowl for sugar. And I'll break in here again and say that I don't usually eat much sugary stuff. In fact, one of my vices is definitely my taste for artificial sweeteners. But I've noticed that the foodstuffs that have caught my eye in recent days have been sugary things. Like, I was at my usual COSA meeting on Monday, and my eye kept my gaze, and I'd have to turn my head to actually look at it, but it kept drifting over to a couple of jars of peanut butter, which were on the floor by the wall in the room where we were having our meeting. And the other day I was going through the Opera House movie theater, as I often do, because the meetings that I record in the basement on Tuesdays are in that same building. And I was looking over at the list of, not the list, but the samples of candy in the display case at the counter at the movie theater, and my eye was drawn to all manner of sugary treats, which normally, you know, when I'm not fasting, I would never even be remotely tempted to purchase and eat. So returning to the article, there is, however, a fallback. Ketone bodies, which are highly acidic compounds created when fatty acids are broken down for energy. The best-known ketone is acetone, as in the clear, flammable liquid used to remove nail polish or scour metal surfaces before painting. Once thought to be waste products, ketones are, in fact, fuel, and fuel that can power the brain. There is evidence that the brain may even run more efficiently on ketones, perhaps because ounce for ounce they contain more energy than glucose. If so, this may account for the heightened sense of well-being and even euphoria that some fasters describe. From the faster's perspective, the only drawback to ketones is that the starving brain does not start using them immediately upon exhausting all available glucose. Instead, it nibbles on muscle for a while, 2 or 3 days, with dolorous results. And I had to look up dolorous. It means feeling or expressing great sorrow or distress. And I will say that on the day that I started fasting, last Friday, I went to the gym and I took a picture. I took several pictures of myself, you know, as the before photos. And I went to the gym yesterday wearing the exact same clothes. So it's not the clothes that made the difference. And I took photos and, dolorous results for sure. It seemed that my muscles were, they were flat. And my midsection, you know, particularly my waist, was just as thick as always. I'll post the pictures. I'll probably put them in a video, but I'll also post them to the MeWe group. Back to the article. While my brain was dithering thus, further changes were occurring within me. My sense of smell had grown fantastically sharp. I'll say that that has not happened to me. And the blood vessels of my temples had begun pumping heartily. Previous fasts had taught me that over the next few days, the pumping would become so robust that I would be able to count my pulse without putting finger to head. The first time I had experienced such throbbing, I worried that it portended a stroke. But that proved hypochondriacal. My heart, I later learned, was merely working harder to compensate for a drop in blood pressure. I'll stop here and say, yeah, I've had that exact same experience. In fact, I can often, not always, but often see my pulse in my eye, like my vision pulses with my heartbeat. Although the drop in blood pressure was harmless in the main, it had one danger. If I stood up too quickly, my blood might not stand up with me. The few doctors who prescribe fasting today say the greatest risk in a fast lies not where the layman might suppose, damage to the stomach, say, or to the liver, heart, or other such organs, but in a contusion or concussion brought about by fainting. The remedy is simple. When feeling lightheaded, the faster sits or lies down immediately. I found this precept more sensible than a daily enema and honored it punctiliously. So I'll say I've never had to sit or lie down quickly because of lightheadedness on this fast, even while working out. And I'll talk about working out after, you know, several days fasting and a bit. In June of 1965, a Scotsman of 27 years and 32 and a half stone, which is to say 456 pounds, presented himself to the Department of Medicine, Royal Infirmary in Dundee, with the desire to lose weight. The fellows of the department, thinking the dire case might call for dire measures, suggested that not eating for a short period might help him control his appetite. They did not intend a prolonged fast. As recently as mid-century, some reference works still proclaimed the certain fatality of modest fasts. Again, this is in 1965. Quote, generally, death occurs after 8 days of deprivation of food, close quote, Funk and Wagnall's New Standard Encyclopedia reported, in the same edition in which it reported fasts of 40 and 60 days by great hunger artists of old. The Scotsman, known in the annals of science only as A.B., agreed to the fast, and the fellows hospitalized him as a precaution. For several days, he took only water and vitamin pills. His vital signs were normal. He asked if he might continue his fast at home, and the doctors released him, on condition that he return for periodic tests of his urine and blood. The checkups were not intended to make sure he wasn't sneaking food, but they had that incidental effect. 1 week disappeared into the next, taking with it on par 5 of AB's pounds. His checkup showed that he had less sugar in his blood than a normal man, but his movements and thinking were not impaired. If he weighed 400 plus pounds, his movements surely were impaired. Summer turned to fall and fall to winter, but A.B. continued vigorous. During the fourth and fifth months, the fellows thought it prudent to supplement his daily vitamin with potassium, but that was all. They could find no reason to halt the fast, and A.B. was so determined to reach his target of 180 pounds that he probably would not have heard of it anyway. He celebrated a year without food with a glass of water. 17 days later, 276 pounds the lesser, he reached his mark. He ate, but not from hunger. A.B. did not recidivate. Over the next 5 years, he added just 16 pounds to his 180. His case was reported in the Postgraduate Medical Journal in 1973, and the Guinness Book of World Records cited him for longest fast, although Guinness later removed the honor for fear of inspiring unsupervised imitators. Heaviest weight dangled from a swallowed sword remains. By Thursday, much of the odd-in-my-head feeling had gone. But a moderate pain now assaulted my lower back. Let me just bust in here and say that, yeah, I had severe back pain during the first few days of my fast, but I had back pain before I started the fast. Continuing from the article, some fasters believe this lumbago, a fasting commonplace, is caused by toxins dislodged by fats that are burned during a fast. Most toxins, so the hypothesis goes, are flushed out of the body via urine and sweat, but some take up an uncomfortable residence in the lower back. There is little evidence to support the lumbago hypothesis, but there is some evidence, more generally, that fasting detoxifies. For more than a week in 1984, 16 Taiwanese victims of PCB poisoning were quasi-fasted. They ate nothing for 1 day and drank a modest amount of juice thereafter. Subsequently, their PCB-induced migraines, hacking coughs, skin pustules, hair loss, numbness, and joint pain either faded or disappeared entirely. At noon, I went for a walk with my wife, who told me I was frigid. I thought this unkind, particularly as I had let her rub my lower back most of the morning, but she clarified that my hand, which she was holding, was cold, an observation never before made of a human hand, living or dead, out of doors in a Tennessee August. Having lived in Tennessee for 2 years, I can confirm that. By nightfall, my feet would become cold, too, and I would have to wear socks to bed. Next day, I took to wearing fleece outside and sometimes even in. My coldness, I surmised, was due to my lack of heat-generating digestion. I've been a bit cold here, but it's been frickin' cold here. It's winter in Vermont. Continuing. In the afternoon, I went for a 2-mile jog, as I had the previous 3 days, at a pace set by my 9-year-old dog. I felt fine. Later, I tried touch football, at a pace set by my 7-year-old son. I nearly collapsed. Similar experiments over coming days taught me that although I could exercise moderately for 20, 40, even 60 minutes, just a few bursts of vigorous effort sent me gasping to the couch. I later read that such bursts are powered by glycogen, which I had used up days ago. So I guess here I'll break in with my reports of trying to lift weights after several days fasting. The first time I went to the gym after the start of my fast was on Monday, so it was on my third full day of fasting. And I did about half of my usual workout, like about half the number of exercises I would normally do. And I did lower the weights, you know, just right off the bat, just taking it easy, you know, cut them back by maybe a quarter. And while I was walking around and feeling sort of fatigued and a bit lightheaded when I wasn't lifting the weights, once I was actually under the weights and pushing them, I had pretty much as much strength as I normally do, which was a surprise to me. And then, you know, resting between sets, again, I felt really spent and really just out of it. But then for the next set, you know, the strength was there, which was, it was an odd sort of back and forth. But then I didn't go to the gym the next day, Tuesday, but I did go yesterday, Wednesday, which was my fifth full day of fasting. And I did not have nearly the strength that I did on Monday. And what I found interesting was that normally when I'm working out, if I do a set to failure, which means, you know, go until I can't lift anymore, I don't really feel that in my muscles. It's more like just a running out of fuel over the whole body. I don't feel it in the muscle that's being worked. But fasting, I did feel it in the muscle that was being worked. And I have no hypothesis to account for that. But I decided when I was at the gym yesterday that that was my last visit to the gym on this fast. So back to the article, and backing up just a little bit. I later read that such bursts are powered by glycogen, which I had used up days ago. That night, I weighed myself. I had not done so since starting the fast because I wanted the satisfaction of seeing a substantial drop when finally I did. Even so, I wasn't prepared when I took to the scale and the needle stopped just shy of 151, a decline of 9 pounds, more than 2 a day. It wasn't possible. Most fasters lose 1.5 pounds a day in their first weeks. 2 is rare, let alone more than 2. I dismounted, fiddled with the scale's calibration, remounted. The needle stopped at 151. I did not protest further. At that rate, I was pleased to calculate I would reach 135 in just one more week, though I knew I wouldn't maintain quite that rate. Fasters start like hares, thanks to the rapid emptying of the digestive tract and the initial loss of water, but after that they lope along. Still, if I had accelerated the first dash, it stood to reason that my lope would be accelerated too. I was certain that my daily exercise, which most fasters forego, had made the difference, and since I would keep exercising, I was equally certain I would see 135 in 10 to 12 days rather than the 3 weeks I had originally envisioned. Clearly, I was a fasting prodigy. And back to my own experience, you know, a few years ago, I guess it's been 8 years since I discovered intermittent fasting. Intermittent fasting was not rapid weight loss for me. This was when I was eating 5 hours a day and fasting 19 hours every day. The weight loss was, it was consistent for a time. And I went from 216 down to about 195 and then plateaued. I just stabilized at 195. And then after, I just continued, you know, the fast five. And for a few weeks, I was at 195. And then I started to lose weight again. I got down to 185 eventually. And I was not doing much exercise. I was taking Tai Chi class with Peter Kienfeld there on the farm. And I would do push-ups and makeshift pull-ups on a metal spiral staircase. But really, I wasn't lifting weights. I wasn't exercising really methodically or regularly. I guess it was fairly regular, but not really intense. But it took me several months of intermittent fasting to go from about 216 down to about 185. When I got on the ketogenic diet last year, again, I was around 216 when I started, though it wasn't the same 216 that I was at when I was at the farm when I first discovered intermittent fasting. I had been lifting weights pretty consistently for the 2 years before I started the ketogenic diet, so much of that 216 pound was muscle, whereas a lot more of that 216 pounds back in 2011 was fat. But in the first week of the ketogenic diet, I lost like 8 or 9 pounds over the course of 5 days. Like, it dropped off really quickly, and I was eating, and I wasn't even on the fast five. I mean, I was fasting most of the day at work, but I took a couple hard-boiled eggs for lunch every day, and then I was eating like a total pig at night. You know, that's when I was staying with Marty in North Carolina, and we went out to restaurants quite often. There was lots of restaurants that Marty wanted to show me, and we did some serious eating there. But, you know, I avoided the carbs and pigged out on lots of meat and cheese and like country fried steak and things like that. And, you know, of course, I had to have a few biscuits, because when you're in the South, you got to eat biscuits. But it was strange. I lost weight faster initially on the ketogenic diet than I have this past week eating absolutely nothing. In fact, while I have lost, you know, around 10 pounds over the course of the past 7 days, actually it's only been 6 days, I've been surprised every morning when I get on the scale to see really how little weight I've actually lost. It's like the body, when you stop eating, the body seems to understand that no food is forthcoming, and it changes things such that it really holds on to what it has and I guess mobilizes fat, but does so at a very deliberate pace. So returning to the article. In the 1960s, a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania named Garfield G. Duncan became troubled by the epidemic of American obesity, This is in the 1960s. Which then afflicted a shocking one man in 20 and one woman in 9. Today, it afflicts 1 in 3 men and women alike. Like other researchers, Duncan fasted obese patients and studied how many regained their lost weight. Unlike other researchers, he noticed that the blood pressure of every patient who was hypertensive fell to within normal limits during these fasts. He reported, for illustration, the case of a man of 53 years and 325 pounds, whose unmedicated blood pressure was 210 over 130, and whose medicated blood pressure was 184 over 106, still menacingly high. The man fasted for 14 days without drugs, and his blood pressure fell to 136 over 90. 6 months later, it was 130 over 75. Duncan did not record how many of his patients sustained such improvements after their fasts, but the possibility of a simple cure for some form of hypertension seemed well worth pursuing. Not until 2001, however, was there a definitive follow-up to his work. Its author, Alan Goldhamer, had fasted thousands of patients at his True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California, and had seen high blood pressures trill downward like Coast Range streams. He studied 174 hypertensives who fasted for 10 days. 154 of them became normotensive by fast's end. The others also enjoyed substantial drops in pressure, and all who had been taking medication were able to stop. In patients with stage 3, the most severe hypertension, the average drop in systolic pressure was 60 mmHg. I don't know how to read that properly. In all patients, the average drop in systolic diastolic was 37 over 13. According to Goldhamer, this was and remains the largest reported drop in blood pressure achieved by any drug or therapy. Like Duncan, Goldhamer did not formally study how long his patients maintained their newly lowered blood pressures, but he surveyed 42 subjects 6 months after their fasts, and their average blood pressure had risen hardly a jot. His findings are all but unknown. A drug company can advertise its latest blood pressure pill with a budget approximating that of the Kingdom of Belgium, but the promotional funds are somewhat less for a program in which people go to a low-cost clinic to receive a treatment consisting of, well, nothing. Then, too, fasting labors under the hoary misapprehension that it is not only injurious, but requires impossible willpower. Not eat for a week? Most people would rather die. All right, this is a very long article. I've been reading for an hour, and when I edit out the misstarts and flubs, it'll probably still come to about 50 minutes. So I'm just going to make a few observations here and then wrap up this podcast, and I will continue with this reading quite soon. That last bit that I read, though, that most people think that fasting requires Herculean willpower, is simply not true. I do not have Herculean willpower. And really, the only day that any sort of willpower is required is the first day of the fast. You know, the times when your body just expects to eat. And sometimes you find yourself standing in the kitchen with the fridge door open, looking in, and you realize, wait a second, I'm not eating. But after the first day, and this, I know every person who reports on a fast says this, and people who have never fasted probably just don't believe it. After the first day, you don't feel hungry. I haven't eaten, it's Thursday, I haven't eaten since last Friday, and I'm not hungry. I think about food pretty often, but I don't experience the limbic hunger, you know, that sensation of the anticipation of pleasure that you know you can produce in yourself by performing a certain action. And that action is, you know, putting something in your mouth, chewing and swallowing. My thoughts of food are not accompanied by that sensation. And so now deciding when to break my fast is not one of how long can I hold out. You know, it's not a question of the state of my willpower. It's really just a deliberative decision. It's like, And here's where this is all headed. On Christmas Day, a neighbor here, a friend that I met before, you know, I met on Facebook, ironically enough, even before I even moved to Bellows Falls, but who was moving here just shortly after Olga and I got here, she is having a Christmas Day get-together because, you know, she's from L.A., Olga and I are from New York, and we have other friends here who are transplants from Boston, And there are a lot of people here in town, you know, the newcomers, who don't have family here and who, you know, don't really have much to do that's special on Christmas Day. So, you know, she's having a Christmas Day party. And there's going to be a lot of good food there. And it is my desire to go there and pig out on Christmas Day. And I'm certainly not going to go and pig out the day after I end a fast. Or I'm definitely not going to end a fast by going to a party and, you know, eating a bunch of food. So I've decided to stop on Saturday just because I want to have a few days between the end of my fast and that Christmas Day party in which to get my whole system back into the habit of eating and digesting and, you know, just all of that. So it's totally a calculated decision that I'm going to have some beef broth on Saturday morning. It's not, I mean, as I say, I have these two boxes of protein bars, and one of which is just a total guilty pleasure of mine. I, you know, when I first discovered them, and even after, I would sometimes abuse them, eating three and four of them in a day, just because they taste good and it feels good, you know, to eat. But I have these two boxes sitting almost within arm's reach. I could step over there and, you know, open one and pull out a bar and unwrap it and jam it in my mouth and start chewing, and I'm not the least bit tempted to do so. I was at the TV station yesterday, coming back from the gym. The gym and the TV station are basically, they're in the same building, they're on the same hallway in the building. So I regularly, you know, when I leave the gym, I stop by the TV station just to chat. And two of the younger guys there, one of whom is pretty fat, I have to say. He's a teenager, he's in high school, and he's not fat all over. He's got a big belly, a substantial belly, and his father is quite fat all over. But I stopped in, and the topic of fasting came up, and, you know, the fat kid said, "I could never go without eating. I could never fast." And the other guy, who just last year actually lost a fairly substantial amount of weight by reducing his caloric intake, said, "Yeah, I don't have the willpower for it either." And I tried to tell him, it only requires willpower on the first day. Thereafter, you're basically an automatic pilot. And neither one of them would entertain that notion. They simply refused to believe or envision that they might, you know, stop eating for any length of time. And from long personal experience, I can tell you, fasting is way, way easier than eating small quantities of food. But what else to say on this topic? I know a number of you listening have experimented with fasting, either intermittent fasting or longer fasts. So I would certainly like to hear from you, and I will include your contributions in the next episode of the podcast, which I plan to have out tomorrow, actually. I'm definitely in catch-up mode here. But if you have any questions or if you want to voice any concerns or any observations, this is my topic right now. You know, I've known a few people who were transitioning from one gender to the other, and they're kind of a pain to be around because that's the only thing they want to talk about. I mean, that's the only subject of conversation for them is their transition. And if you're not doing it yourself, I mean, it's interesting for a time, but thereafter it becomes uninteresting. And I guess fasting is kind of like that. You know, when I'm walking around, haven't eaten in nearly a week, to me, that's the primary subject of conversation. But people's responses to it are so routine and predictable that it's really not very interesting to talk to people who have themselves not fasted. Anyway, I will continue with this reading possibly later today, but I certainly won't get the podcast out until tomorrow. But enjoy this one, and know that I will talk to you again quite soon, and that I am wishing you happy holidays. And I do not shy away from saying Merry Christmas, so for those of you who are Christian, or, you know, just maybe culturally Christian like me, and who still have fond memories of Christmas and value Christmas, let me just say, Merry Christmas. But there are other holidays around this time, and I hope that they are happy holidays for you. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.